It was the first time that I was a messenger of death. I was a first-year pastor whose telephone rang in the early evening, and I was told about the death of a man on the other side of the country and asked if I would go and inform his adult daughter about that death. The church was small, the town was small. I thought I had a pretty good idea where she and her husband were, probably at the home of friends. So I got in my car, and as I drove over there, I passionately prayed all the way that God would go with me, that God would give me the words to say, because I had no idea how to handle this, no idea how to go about it. When I arrived at the front door of the host's home and knocked on the door, and he came and opened the door, it was obvious that it was bad news, just the fact that I was there unexpected and unannounced. I asked if I could talk with the couple that was visiting them, and we were ushered into a small room where we sat down together, and I told her that her dad had just died. And I had to fight back my own tears and my own emotions to try to stay in control and kind of be there for them. It was a few months later that the daughter's husband told me that I really wasn't very good at death notifications. And perhaps that was a criticism. Actually, I think it was a criticism. But I decided to take it instead as a compliment because I concluded that was something I didn't want to be very good at. It's something I hope not to have to do very often. And I decided that, well, I want it to always be a hard thing to tell someone else that the person that you love has died. The Old Testament book of 1 Samuel ends with the battlefield deaths of Israel's King Saul and Prince Jonathan on Mount Gilboa. The sons of the king were killed by enemy swords, and the king himself was mortally wounded by enemy arrows. He was dying, and he was fearful that the Philistines, with all the nasty things he knew them to do, would torture and humiliate him. And so he chose to commit suicide rather than fall into the hands of the enemy. David and his men were miles away. They were exempted from the Battle of Mount Gilboa. They had walked for 3 days in order to go back to their town of Ziklag, only to discover that their houses were burned down, that their wives and children were kidnapped, and their possessions were all gone. God gave them special directions, so they were able to find the terrorists and not only retrieve their possessions, but get all of their families back and preserve them from being sold on Middle Eastern slave markets. It was, for them, a day of delight and a day of dismay. Delight because they had gotten their families and possessions back, and a day of dismay because of the destruction of their homes. And then came the messenger of death. It's the opening lines of the Old Testament book of 2 Samuel. That after the death of Saul, David returned from defeating the Amalekites and stayed in Ziklag 2 days. On the third day, a man arrived from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and with dust on his head. When he came to David, he fell to the ground to pay him honor. "Where have you come from?" David asked him. He answered, "I've escaped from the Israelite camp." "What happened?" David asked. "Tell me." He said, "The men fled from the battle. Many of them fell and died, and Saul and his son Jonathan are dead." Then David said to the young man who brought him the report, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" I happened to be on Mount Gilboa," the young man said. "And there was Saul leaning on his spear with the chariots and riders almost upon him. When he turned around and saw me, he called out to me, and I said, 'What can I do?' And he asked me, 'Who are you?' 'An Amalekite,' I answered. Then he said to me, 'Stand over me and kill me. I'm in the throes of death, but I'm still alive.' So I stood over him and killed him because I knew that after he had fallen, he could not survive. And I took the crown that was on his head and the band on his arm and had brought them here to my lord." David loved Saul. David loved Jonathan. Even though King Saul had made himself David's enemy, even though he had put a price on his head, even though he had tried to personally kill him, David had remained completely loyal to his king. And Jonathan, even though they were separated by war and politics and family and circumstances, they still were the very best of friends. Let me tell you that there is no good way to tell someone that a loved one has died. But this Amalekite could not have done much worse. He was an Amalekite. As far as David was concerned, all Amalekites were terrorists. When the message was delivered, they're standing in the middle of a community that has been burned out, all of their homes destroyed. He's just come back from a battle in which he has rescued his own family and regained his own possessions because of what the Amalekites had done. It's true. This messenger didn't know about that, and he wasn't part of it. But you can't help but conclude that David must have been prejudiced against him just because he was an Amalekite. And this Amalekite totally, totally misjudged David's response to the news that he heard. He assumed that David would be glad that the king was dead because the king was out to kill David. He assumed that David would immediately ascend to the throne of Israel. He assumed that David would be completely delighted that Prince Jonathan was dead because that would be one less impediment between him and the crown. And he could not have been more wrong. David was loyal to King Saul. He loved Prince Jonathan. He was shocked to dismay by what had happened and the announcement that was made, which is a lesson to us that when others grieve, we need to be very, very slow to assume what they think and feel, because people grieve differently. Just because of the way we did it, or what we think, or what is our interpretation, does not mean that our experience is their experience. And so we ought not be like this Amalekite who completely misunderstood the heartbreak of David and of his men. And then this messenger lied to make himself look good. He said he did it. He said, I killed King Saul. That wasn't true at all. King Saul had taken his own life. He had committed suicide. And he had misjudged again, assuming that David would be glad that Saul was dead and thinking that perhaps he would get some kind of a reward because he was the one who had done it. So this Amalekite messenger, he messed up big time. But as God often does, God used his foolishness for good. Because when this Amalekite had come on Mount Gilboa to the body of King Saul, he had stripped off it the king's crown and the royal band around the king's arm. He had brought it to David as a presentation on the assumption that David would immediately become the next king of Israel, and this Amalekite would receive honor and reward for doing it. The truth is that it would be years of civil war before David would fully become the king of all of Israel. And yet, that was God's intent, and that was where God was taking all this. The irony of it is that this first public acknowledgement of David as the king comes from this lying, thieving terrorist of an Amalekite. And that God had used those circumstances toward accomplishing his purposes. God does that. God takes the most bizarre things, the most foolish of behavior, and he spins them around and turns them inside out to accomplish very good purposes. And so while the crown was not yet on David's head, it was now in David's hand. This messenger must have been totally shocked by what he next saw and heard. And that is that David and his entire mini army of 600 and all of the families with them did not rejoice. This was not good news. They did not celebrate. Then David and all the men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. They mourned and wept and fasted till evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and the house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword. They were hit by grief. And grief can hit you like a freight train. None of us can predict the way we're going to grieve. You can think you know. You can think that when you get that telephone call or when you find out, this is the way you will handle it and what your response will be. And you may be totally shocked by the surprise of what grief does to you. Some of us, we grieve in silence. And we grieve alone, facing life's great losses. Others of us lash out in anger against anyone that is within reach or within range. Some of us, when we grieve, we act out in ways that 6 months later we don't even remember. When someone tells us what we said or did, we are shocked that that was the way we handled it because we have blocked it out of our minds. David and his men, they tore their clothes. They wept and groaned and moaned and could not eat because they had much to mourn about. Their nation had been defeated. The army of Israel had been devastated. Their king was dead. Their leader's best friend was gone. It was total shock, horrific loss. You know, grief is just strange stuff. It does the unpredictable. It catches you by surprise. You think you're doing just fine. You're finally settled in. You've got some comfort and peace. And then grief sneaks up behind you, just slams you across your head. Or you think, I'll never be able to do it. I won't be able to speak at the funeral. I won't be able to make the telephone call. I won't be able to go back to a family gathering or return to work. And you discover a strength and a stamina that you never would have anticipated or ever expected. Grief is strange stuff. And so David, who was shocked and not eating and ripping his clothes and weeping, gathered himself together. He stopped crying. He stood up as a military officer and as a political leader. David said to the young man who brought him the report, "Where are you from?" "I'm the son of an alien, an Amalekite," he answered. David asked him, "Why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of his men and said, "Go strike him down." So he struck him down and he died. For David had said to him, "Your blood be on your own head. Your own mouth testified against you when you said, 'I killed the Lord's anointed.'" And so David did what a lot of us do in grief. Whatever the loss is that we are facing, there are a lot of us who just lash out. We just lash out against the messenger or anyone that is there. He was so anguished over the deaths of Saul and Jonathan that he just had to do something. And the messenger became the target of the anger that he had. Now understand that David was not yet officially the king of Israel, but he took the prerogative of the crown, the prerogative of capital punishment. And he ordered the execution of this Amalekite. It must have seemed a very easy verdict to reach and sentence to give. After all, this guy was an Amalekite. And David and everybody knew that the Amalekites were terrorists. They were a plague to Israel, even to the other nations like Philistia. But more than that, this guy had confessed to the crime that he had committed. David said it. "Your own mouth testified against you when you said, 'I killed the Lord's anointed.'" So what more does a judge and a jury need? This wasn't hearsay. They were there. This guy confessed right out in front of everybody, "I killed King Saul." So there is no doubt about the confession. And David then ordered his execution and he was killed. Except he didn't do it. He lied. It was a foolish and false confession. And that day, David, not yet king, executed an innocent man. Real life is seldom simple or easy. Real life is messy. In real life, very guilty people will look you straight in the eye and say, "I didn't do it," with a credibility that just about convinces you. and innocent people confess to crimes that they did not commit. It's upside down and backwards. And David did what we're all tempted to do. He immediately jumped to what was the obvious and the tragic conclusion. And he had a man killed who was innocent. It's a mistake that we must never make, or at least try never to make, that in the heat of the emotion, we quickly connect dots and we see a picture that in fact isn't there. And we respond in haste and with emotion and anger, dealing with the reality of grief that we are struggling over, and we make a judgment that is a terrible decision. This was a terrible choice that David made with far-reaching consequences. So let's learn a lesson from David. Don't kill the messenger. Recently, I read the advice of a Christian grief counselor. She said, "I urge those who are grieving to review their loss, talk about it openly, think about it thoroughly, write about it reflectively, and pray through it." And then she added, "It's my experience that people want to run from their pain. They want to replace pain with another feeling as soon as they can. To recover from pain, you have to face it. You must stand in it and process it before it will dissipate, for that is God's way." And that's what David finally did. He wrote about it. He wrote a poem, a lyric poem, and the music to go with it. A song that he taught to his friends and fellow soldiers and to their families. A song, they called it a psalm. It's not included in the Old Testament book of Psalms, even though 72 of the 150 songs or psalms that are there were written by David or attributed to him. Now, this was one that was in addition to all of that. He wanted everybody to learn to sing it so that they would not forget and would share in their grief. David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan and ordered that the men of Judah be taught this lament of the bow. It is written in the book of Jasher. "Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on your heights. How the mighty have fallen! Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised rejoice. O mountains of Gilboa, may you have neither dew nor rain, nor fields that yield offerings of grain. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul no longer rubbed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the flesh of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. The sword of Saul did not return unsatisfied." Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and gracious, and in death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Oh, daughters of Zion, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. How the mighty have fallen. The weapons of war have perished. These are the words of a man who is grieving, grieving from every angle. He compares the way things were and the way things are. And he says, "Oh, how the mighty have fallen. Mighty King Saul, from the throne, a great military leader, anointed by God, filled by his spirit, victor in battle, loved by his country, and he's gone. How the mighty have fallen." David wants to keep what has happened a secret from the enemy. He knows he can't. But he says, "May this not be told in the enemy, the Philistine cities of Ashkelon and of Gath, Because he can't stand the thought that there will be people out on the streets celebrating over such a great loss, his loss. He fantasizes and imagines that Mount Gilboa, where those he loved has died, that it won't rain there anymore, that grain won't grow there anymore. The place can never be the same again. It can't go back. Not that place where David had lost Saul and Jonathan. He just yearns that they be remembered well. And even though there was a lot that was not good to remember, he recalls them as being loved and gracious. He says to the women of Israel, remember what he was like. The way under his rule there was prosperity, that you wore dresses that were adorned with gold. And then he does something that I think most of us do. When there is the tragic death of someone we love, we find any little piece of good news. And the only good news he could find was that Saul and Jonathan died together. They died side by side. And then he forcefully declares his love for Jonathan. Not a sexual love, as some 21st century readers have tried to impose upon what David wrote, but rather the love between two men who are the best of friends, and their love had been severed by death. So these words that David wrote, are they literal? Are they even rational? Well, of course not. This is not the cold report of some coroner. This is the grief, the emotion, the heart of someone who has lost those he deeply loved. David's grief was deep and painful. But you know, as we turn the page's future into David's later biography, we discover that he healed, that he went on. And we want to ask him, how did you do that? How do you go on when you lose a job, when a dream is shattered? How do you do that when a relationship that you valued is broken? How do you do that when you lose your mom or your dad or your brother or your sister or your home? Or how do you go on when you lose a child? And David would tell us, you grieve deeply. And you trust God. Grieve deeply with the memories of yesterday. And trust God for the hope of tomorrow. A pastor faced a situation that I've told of before. One of the most indescribable losses that anyone could ever have, with the suicide death of his son. 10 days later, he stood before his congregation to preach a sermon based on the text of Romans 8:28, which says that we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. He stood before that congregation and said that he could not fit his son's death into those words. He could not find any good to talk about. And then he said, it's like the miracle of the shipyard. Almost every part of our great ocean-going vessels are made of steel. If you take any single part, be it a steel plate out of the hull or the huge rudder, throw it into the ocean, it will sink. Steel doesn't float. But when the shipbuilders are finished, when the last plate has been riveted into place, then the massive steel ship is virtually unsinkable. Taken by itself, my son's suicide is senseless. Throw it into the sea of Romans 8:28 and it sinks. Still, I believe that when the eternal shipbuilder has finally finished, when God has worked out his perfect design, even the senseless tragedy will somehow work to our eternal good. Like David, like that grieving father, when we experience the great losses of life, grieve and trust grieve deeply for those who have been lost and trust fully in the God of tomorrow. Our Lord, we are sad to say that losses in life and grief are the common and universal human experience. And so, whether in today's grief or the grief that is coming in some future day, may we learn from the lessons and the words of David to grieve deeply over those that we have lost and to trust fully in you, the God who heals us into tomorrow. In Jesus' name, amen.